This week on the Canadian Tech Podcast, Amazon's first Canadian data center is open. We look at the battle of the mesh networking devices. Pebble is dead, and AMD's trying to go toe-to-toe with NVIDIA. That's all next, and more on the Canadian Tech Podcast. The Canadian Tech Podcast is sponsored by Olio Digital Labs. Olio are the planners, designers, and developers of the apps used by some of Canada's biggest brands. Find out what Olio can do for you at oliodigitallabs.com.
Welcome to the Canadian Tech Podcast, episode 98, for Tuesday, December 13, 2016, sponsored by Olio Digital Labs. My name is Stuart Clark.
And my name is Derek Silva.
Well, Derek, another week's come and gone. First of all, I should apologize for the delay in recording this. Had a few life events happen. Things got kind of busy. So we're doing it on a Tuesday. But nevertheless, we still have some amazing news to cover this week in tech, don't we?
We do. It was a very busy week last week.
It was. So we're going to kick it right off. We actually covered the original announcement of this. Amazon has finally debuted their first AWS region in Canada. There's going to be out of Montreal. There's going to be, they're calling it AWS Canada Central. There'll be two availability zones, so two separate physical data centers. It's going to be really good who want customers who want for either their data stored locally for regulatory reasons or compliance reasons, or even if they're running some really important things, they want the lowest possible latency. So this basically means Amazon now, they have 40 separate availability zones across 15 regions. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's just people, I still think people don't realize how big Amazon is for the models change things. What do you think?
Yeah, and sorry to any listeners, you're cutting out a little bit. Hopefully that improves as I close a few more browser tabs here. Okay. Yeah, Amazon's Amazon's latest AWS region is up. It is in Montreal. It's about time, I must say. A lot of other VPS and cloud computing providers already have Canadian locations. OVH, which is originally from France, they've had a data center in Montreal for a while. iWeb, yes, it's called iWeb.
iWeb, yeah.
They're owned by PhoenixNAP now, but they've done a lot of work in this space as well, and have for quite some time. DigitalOcean, VPS.net, a bunch of other companies have Canadian locations. So great to see Amazon get on the bandwagon. We know Microsoft Azure is as well. Still, I think, beta testing Toronto and Montreal. But I think the most surprising thing out of this announcement was that Brendan, the managing partner at Olio, said, okay, well, but which services are available out of Montreal? I went, well, I'm glad you asked, because I had the email that actually listed them all. And, oh, man, a couple of dozen services. Like, it was almost every single one except for all the brand new ones just announced at the AWS reInvent keynote speeches last week. But, like, all the mainstays, EC2, CloudFront, CloudWatch, S3, Glacier, and so on and so forth, all the ones that most developers know about, they're all there. They're all available, hosted out of Canada now. This will be really good for people who like using Amazon Web Services, but had potential clients or existing clients say, no way, my stuff stays here in Canada. Doesn't have to be from a Canadian company necessarily, but the data stays right here. And now that will no longer be a problem for Amazon specifically. So it can only be good for them. It can only be good for folks for Canadians who already enjoy using Amazon Web Services overall, and have had, protests or, you know, hesitancy from clients or what have you, for putting their data in the U.S. Weren't they testing a Toronto location as well?
I believe so. Now, it does say two availability zones, so you got to wonder if one's going to be in Toronto or calling the region the central region.
It could
so,
be, yeah.
You know, there might be something more in the press release. Yeah, because normally when they do that, it's two separate areas. with new, you know, in Montreal, so it might be two different data centers in Montreal. Now, the other thing too is, you know, these are some pretty big players coming on board. Like we're talking the National Bank, Total Star, BC Hydro, University of Alberta, Shaw, you know, so there's a lot of players already wanting on, and, you know, and just the same as you, I remember dealing with customers in some of my previous jobs where I didn't want that data, you know, going outside of the country. So this is really, really good. Really good to see. And I'm not surprised the absolute latest and greatest that they've announced, because again, I think we'll definitely be seeing that more and more. And again, it's another reason for businesses to look at cloud computing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in general.
All right. Moving on from Amazon to trucks. We all like trucks. You
we
have
do.
A son, I'm sure. You have kids. They love trucks, I'm sure.
They
yeah.
do.
So and... Nikola reveals a... Sorry, I was going to say they reveal a hydrogen fuel cell powered truck. This thing has a range of 1,200 miles, aiming for 2020 release. That's pretty amazing. This is your story, so I'm going to let you roll with this.
Yeah, so this is a company... Well, the inspiration for the name is the same as Tesla. We have Tesla Motor Company, of course, based out of California. Now we have Nikola Motor Company. Put them together and you have Nikola Tesla, the inventor of many things. So Nikola Motor Company has unveiled a huge Class 8 truck, which is as big as it gets. It is powered by a hydrogen fuel cell, as you said. 1,900 kilometer range, as much as, of course, when it's released in 2020. As you mentioned, that's not that far away. And the really nice thing is that this is obviously designed for long-haul transport across large land masses. When you're getting between 800 to 1,200 miles on a single tank, you can obviously do all the same, or at least most of the same sorts of things 18-wheelers do now. And the hydrogen fuel cell-driven engine delivers over 1,000 horsepower and over 2,000 foot-pounds of torque, which is a lot.
Wow. Yeah.
That would actually provide about almost double the power of the current generation of diesel-powered semi-trucks or articulated lorries, as they're called overseas. It's a fully electric drivetrain with high-density lithium batteries, maybe not lithium-ion specifically. They're charged by the hydrogen fuel cell instead of gas, so same kind of idea as the Chevy Volt, where you actually have fuel being burned, or in this case, some sort of catalyst is converting
right.
it. But we're using hydrogen, which spits out water vapor instead of fossil fuels or carbon dioxide and all that sort of fun stuff. The nice thing about this is that Nikola Motor Company wants to, in conjunction with putting together their truck, wants to put together 364 hydrogen fueling stations across the U.S. and Canada starting in 2018 in order to prep the operating environment for trucks like theirs. And in addition to that, the cab is very high-tech. Looks like an iPad Pro size tablet, like 13, 14 inches. So, almost 20 some centimeters by the looks of it, maybe more. Inside, all LED or like OLED or LCD monitors instead of your traditional gauges. And top that all off with a 40 inch curved 4K TV. Connected to an Apple TV with Wi-Fi, 4G LTE connectivity, a fridge, a freezer, and a microwave. Oh, and I think there's two full size beds available if you're really
wanting. The only thing I wonder is, right now, but I also wonder though. We also talk about self driving trucks and that. You know, is this gonna
Sorry, could you say that again?
I'm saying this might, we talk about self-driving trucks, this would probably be easily converted to a self-driving truck.
I would imagine so, yeah. I could definitely see what's already been tested, where you have a primary driver in one of these, and multiple automated vehicles following behind using aerodynamics and that sort of thing to with a leader and the other ones trailing in order to cut down fuel even more, and so you're using even less hydrogen than you and fuel in general than you would be already. I imagine Nikola has to be looking forward to a future where, you know, the cab is really for someone just to watch and make sure and, you know, load exactly. and help unload like, and unload the vehicle as opposed to driving all the time.
Right. Exactly. Okay. Pretty cool. Okay. Moving on to some more devices, a little bit smaller devices now. Review. There's a lot of things in technology where we talk about mesh Wi-Fi networks. So that's when you have a whole bunch of smaller devices. Maybe you don't have the range, but the idea is it promises to fix those dead zone problems. Depending on how large your house is, you may find if you have the router right in the front of the house, the you find in the back patio you can't get Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. So Google now has one out, and as the article says, it kind of reminds me of the Amazon Echo. This one's called Google Wi-Fi, sold individually for $129 US or a three pack for $299. And it's pretty positive review so far. It's actually a pretty nice design too. It looks like a little white hockey puck, doesn't it? Basically a PowerPoint, 2 gigabit Ethernet jacks. Kind of cool. Two different, your standard thing, 2.4 or 5 gigahertz, 802.11 A, B, G, or N, standard secure WPA 2-PSK. This is actually pretty nice. My router at home, I have a little bit more specialty. I run a Buffalo router with some specialty software so I can do a few more networking geek stuff. But I think for your average household, two-story house, two-car garage, a basement, etc. I think this would work really well. What do you think?
Yeah, what I found really interesting out of this is that now that we have four or five different companies, maybe six, all producing these sometimes partially cloud-controlled services in addition to the mesh networking points, is now we're actually able to do some really good tests across. And so I actually really wanted to highlight the fact that both The Verge and Ars Technica tested multiple different sets of devices and are getting not different results, but we can see results now from more than one publication. So over at The Verge, they were seeing that Wi-Fi, Eero, and Orbi for the reviewer's office, almost all the same, over 200 megabits per second. Where the Netgear Orbi really shined was in the more far-flung places. And part of that is because the Netgear Orbi devices, the one main router access point is huge. It has a ton of antennas inside. It's massive. Not nearly as easy to put out in the middle of your house as the other ones are, because the other ones look like you said, like a white hockey puck, right. or a white a white Roku, essentially, or a white Apple TV. They're quite nice. But the Orbi really shines in what it does. The other reason for that is that it has its own backhaul channel between the two access points. So if you're connecting to a further one, or if you're connecting to one to the auxiliary, and it needs to backhaul traffic to the main access point in order to get to the internet, it has its own dedicated channel for that. So that's very different from Google Wi-Fi, Eero, Plume, or Luma. And so it lets you get 200 megabits per second in a lot of this person's other rooms, even though Google Wi-Fi and the Eero are doing 120 or 80 megabits or something like that. And then you have to factor in the fact that I think Orbi works without any sort of cloud management. Netgear is not analyzing your traffic in order to figure out how to optimize your traffic based on your needs and what you usually do use the internet for. Google Wi-Fi and Eero do. So some of these speed tests might be going, oh, well, this is just another speed test. And so the Google Wi-Fi and Eero are like, oh, we can downplay the importance of this. And therefore, you're only getting 80 megabits per second or maybe even less. That's still a lot. That's still really fast. You can stream a 4K signal over 80 megabits per second. But because eventually it starts to figure out, oh, this is just another speed test, it doesn't necessarily need to... prioritize that traffic. Ars Technica did something different. I won't go too much into it, but they actually mapped how the Plume, the Google Wi-Fi, and I think the Eero are not the Eero, the Ubiquiti Amplify HD, how they all do at actually covering your house with using what's it called? NetSpot, network mapping software. Yep. And so you can actually see on this, I think it was this gentleman's house, like not a blueprint, but a layout, how strong the signal are. And what I found really interesting was that what he found was the Plume has a really nice even spread. Part of the reason for that is Plume anticipates you buying more access points. But they're cheaper as a result. I think they're only $70 US, so probably about $100 right now, almost, as opposed to $170 Canadian, maybe, for a Google Wi-Fi, you know, single Google Wi-Fi or Eero or the Orbi. And so you can actually put one in, you know, in your bedroom and in the kids' room and then in your kitchen and in your living room and in the basement. You can put four or five around the house, and that's what they're anticipating. But you don't have these big, really RF heavy areas of your house that could potentially confuse your devices, your phones, your laptop into having a harder time figuring out which access point to connect to. So really, really interesting. Well worth taking half an hour to read both reviews if you're interested in this space. I really am. I really like the idea of this air freshener looking thing just sticking out of my wall, which is the Plume. I think the design's really nice. If I don't, I'd probably go for either the Google Wi-Fi or the Eero. The reason I say that is because I think both of those sets of devices give you the ability to actually like group a set of devices together and turn the internet off and on at will. So I've got kids, so I can be like, hey, 7 o'clock bedtime, and just turn the network connectivity off on the Roku if the kids aren't listening.
excellent. So yeah, we're gonna keep an eye on that. Okay, also with wireless technology, there's a standard that was Bluetooth 5. Apparently, companies are now going to be able to begin building and certifying devices that work with Bluetooth 5. We should start seeing some stuff in the next 2 to 6 months, major products by the end of the year. Basically, Bluetooth 5 is going to be able to reach up to twice the speeds and to four times the distance of what they are today. So yeah, that's going to be quite good. It's amazing all the different things we have that use Bluetooth. It'll be interesting. The one thing I have to chuckle at with that larger range, there's certain places that, you know, technology hubs and stuff like that, you know, if we fire up our new Bluetooth 5 phone, how many hundreds of devices are we going to see with four times the range?
Yes, that's a valid question. I don't know. What I found most interesting, beyond the speed and the range increases, which are going to be fantastic, especially so two things. One, an actual proper mesh networking standard for Bluetooth that's coming later in 2017 as a revision to Bluetooth 5. But I think they anticipate that working with any chips that come with Bluetooth 5 support. And this kind of what you see similar in, I think it's similar to what you see in 802.11ac Wi-Fi and or .11n and AC, and moving forward is some sort of beam forming where your wireless access point can actually shape the direction of the beam towards your device a little bit. Bluetooth seems to be getting something similar to that, where it's going to adapt your Bluetooth signal on the fly in order to avoid collisions with your Wi-Fi or your LTE connections. So, you know, trying to keep the airwaves clear and make sure that that your Bluetooth signal works well without interfering with your other cellular connectivity or other network connectivity. So that'll be really good.
I wonder if you'll be allowed to cross the streams, because you're not supposed to cross the streams, right? Sorry.
Never cross the streams.
Never cross the streams.
Never.
Okay, this is cool. Okay, now some sad news. All you Pebble smartwatch owners, your brand is dead. No more support. Now that Pebble's confirmed their sale to Fitbit, their hardware is dead, software is in maintenance mode, no warranty, no new products coming out. You know, it kind of confirms what we thought. Fitbit's buying for the patents and stuff like that.
Yeah.
There's no more warranty.
And the software team.
Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah. Again, they had their run, but like everything else, things change. So, I'm not sure what more we can say about this. A Pebble.
I had a reservation in, or like a funding in for the Pebble Time 2. And then I timing wise, I knew I was going to need that money for something else. So I actually canceled it. Regardless, either I would have gotten my Pebble Time 2 by now, or I would be getting a refund. So, I think that's important to say. So anybody who did back the Pebble Core, the Pebble Time 2, or the Pebble Time Round, if you haven't gotten your watch, if you didn't, get, a notification that your Pebble 2 shipped or anything like that, you're not getting it. But you can get a refund. If you're a Kickstarter backer, you should have already gotten it.
By March
next year. Yeah. By March next year, you should immediately or automatically get a refund. Now, if your credit card number has changed since then, you might have a little bit more trouble. You're just going to have to call your credit card issuer and sort that out, but you are going to get your money back. So it's sad. The founder of Pebble is originally, I think he's from Waterloo. He went to University of Waterloo. So he's Canadian. There's the Canadian connection here. I know they moved out to California in order to grow the company and all that, which maybe was a mistake. I don't know. It's sad. It'll be interesting to see what sees the light of day over at Fitbit. I don't know how much. We don't know if there will be any branding associated with Fitbit from Pebble or anything like that, but I did see a lot of people saying, a lot of developers say that they really hope that the hackability of the Pebble OS, they really hope that comes to Fitbit, because that would actually incent them to develop apps and extensions and that sort of thing for Fitbit. So Fitbit could still end up benefiting beyond the code base and the people. They could benefit a little bit if they play their cards right from the Pebble community. So we'll have to see what happens there.
And that would be a nice thing to see.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that would be a nice thing to see, definitely. So, okay. So now we're going to pause here for a brief message from our sponsor, Olio Labs. We always appreciate their support. So here we go.
Hi folks, Derek breaking in here with an ad for our sponsor, Olio Digital Labs. Do you have an idea for a mobile app, a problem that needs solving, or disparate pieces of software that need to speak to each other? The team at Olio Digital Labs is here to help. Olio are the planners, designers, and builders behind the solutions used by some of Canada's biggest brands, and they can also help you. Olio offers custom mobile and web applications, websites, and platforms. To find out how Olio can help you, call 226-785-0420, email derek@oliodigitallabs.com, or visit oliodigitallabs.com to learn more about the company and its services. And now, back to the show.
And we're back. We thank Olio for their support as always. Don't forget, if you need anything, projects, anything like that, feel free to give Derek a call. All right. Intel, AMD, you know, Intel makes a lot of chips, particularly server chips. And up to now, they pretty well had the monopoly, you know, and this is for the stuff that fires, you know, Amazon, Google, Facebook, all these custom thousands and thousands and thousands of servers. Mm-hmm. Well, apparently, Qualcomm's kind of trying to muscle in on their territory. And there's some analysts saying Intel would be very wise to kind of keep an eye on this and see what's happening, because, you know, Qualcomm comes in and they say, hey, we can give you a deal. You know, some of these big players like your Google, Microsoft, they might say to Intel, hey, these guys want to give us a good deal. I think you should cut your prices. So that could do something for Intel share. Again, I like the idea. Competition's healthy. What do you think?
I think it's ARM-based chips in servers has already been happening for a little while now. AMD bought a company called SeaMicro a few years ago, who has already been putting ARM chips into mm-hmm. servers. I have no idea right now how big that business is for AMD, but regardless, this is just another chink in the armor for Intel and their server business. A lot of servers, they don't need Intel Xeon, you know, W5520 octo core, you know, 2-thread per core CPUs. Like they just don't. Either you have small web loads for shared hosting sites like my servers at CleverHost, or you have newer Internet of Things, IoT-based workloads that need to process just a little bit of data from a few hundred sensors or a few thousand sensors. You don't need Intel Xeon processors for that. Not to mention all the whole big reason that we run almost exclusively ARM-based chips with a completely different architecture than Intel x86 chips in our smartphones and our tablets is because of power consumption and heat dissipation as a result. You can't run a lot of Intel chips in a smartphone. Your smartphone it'll turn into a Galaxy Note 7. it's going to explode. It's too hot. And we're already seeing even ARM-based chips from Qualcomm that, you know, where the phones can get pretty warm. There's no way on earth you'd get a phone the size of, or with the thinness of an iPhone or a Galaxy S7 or even my Moto X with the same level of performance from an Intel chip right now. It's just not possible. Level of performance paired with heat dissipation, power consumption, etc. Your phone would be dead in half the time. So if they can bring that level of power consumption and heat dissipation to server workloads with good speeds and with good performance, especially if they're better prices, pardon me, Intel's gonna mm-hmm. have problems. There's still going to be things around like, well, which operating systems can you run and that sort of thing. It's not all solved, but there are lots of Linux distributions already compiled for the CISC architecture, RISC architecture, ARM-based architecture, and they got another hardware boost here.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, yeah, it'll be good. Again, competition's healthy. We're going to have to keep an eye on this one as well. All right, moving on to this is our final story, actually. Radeon. Now, I've kind of tried to read through this through a couple of times, and you're probably going to have to really kind of explain some of this, because I'm thinking this is like universal driver. It's kind of like my NVIDIA card. Is that what they're kind of doing here, and they just got a more optimized driver? Okay, go ahead.
So AMD is maybe potentially finally catching up with NVIDIA in a few ways. Yeah, a big part of this is a single driver for consumer level cards, pro level cards, doesn't matter. One driver download now. That's huge. That's really, really big. And then a bunch of features, primarily for gamers and creative types, again, to bring AMD Radeon graphics cards on par with, or maybe just behind, what you can do with NVIDIA cards. So they have this new Relive, I think it's Relive, feature that includes... a DVR-like instant replay mode.
Relive,
I think.
Yep.
You can stream directly to YouTube and Twitch, huge for gamers that want to broadcast that sort of thing, with instant replay enabled up to the last 20 minutes of gameplay or desktop use is buffered to your disk, so that, you know, if you go on a really cool headshot kill streak, no problem. You can cap, you know, you've got a copy of that and you can upload it to YouTube or wherever. Better hardware acceleration, and because of that, AMD says that Relive has minimal impact, up to 4% tops on your performance. That's pretty good. Relive as a whole, it's an overlay on top of your games and your apps, so it gives you easy access to one-click record, stream and screenshots, your instant replays, custom hotkey support, that sort of thing. For laptop users, the latest Crimson Driver package also includes introduces Radeon Chill. Chill was originally a third party add-on developed by Hyalgo before AMD bought it earlier this year. That automatically reduces the frame rate of a game during static scenes. So if you're just standing around in a field in EverQuest, World of Warcraft, what's that new Overwatch, that sort of thing, just standing around looking around, the frame rate will drop. That will help your laptop deal with the game. That will save you power, that will lower heat, etc. It doesn't work with all games, but AMD has a whitelist for games that will work. World of Warcraft is one of those games, which is still really popular. You can also configure Radeon Chill. I'm not going to get huge into that. You can read the full thing. This is a huge release. I think that's pretty clear. There's a whole lot going on. The other big thing here that I've missed is better Linux support. They've got a free driver now. Oh, I think I just missed it. There it is. They've got an open source Core Linux driver now. That will make a lot of open source zealots, of which I am one of them. I don't use that word in a derogatory way. Really happy. And then there's the proprietary Radeon Pro Linux driver that works on top. So that brings support for things like FreeSync 1.0, Direct GMA, not entirely sure what that is, honestly. Vulkan for Red Hat Enterprise Linux. Vulkan is a set of APIs that lets you write games that work more directly with the hardware instead of it takes away abstraction, I believe, or adds abstraction, but it gives you better results. Official support for CentOS. That's great.
That's
awesome. There's something for everybody here. Better stability, better performance, so on and so forth. Lots of numbers here from AMD's presentation. Last thing I'll mention, support for VMware vSphere 6.5 for desktop and application virtualization. So that'll be huge for a lot of people too.
Yep. Excellent stuff.
That was a lot.
That was
Sorry.
Good. You did good. No. Oh, I know. Yeah. No. So definitely, yeah, it brings it back. Because one thing I remember is back when I had ATI cards, there was always seemed to be different drivers where NVIDIA always had the universal driver.
Yes.
Or some individual tweaks, but yeah, so good for them. It'll be nice coming back, considering the core of AMD stuff was ATI, which is a good Canadian company. I remember years ago driving by their office in Richmond Hill many times.
It's still there. I thought it was Markham.
Still there. Yep. Just different logos. Markham. Richmond Hill, Markham. Kind of all in the same area. I was going to our Richmond Hill office, so I would go through, I would go past there. Okay. I'm still playing around with the new iPhone 7 Plus. It's working very well. Loving the camera. One of the apps I recently upgraded, because this is one of the things I used on the iPad all the time, a Goodreader. So is a PDF app, and it's really awesome because sometimes I'll get subscribed to magazines, like some of my hobby magazines and stuff, and a lot of visuals, and they come as PDFs. And on the old phone, although I could read text fine, my old phone, you really couldn't do stuff like that. The screen was too small. You could do it on a laptop, a PDF, but again, the orientation is wrong. So I would have to borrow my I wouldn't be able to. So one of the things I liked about with the 7 Plus, it's got that larger screen, and Goodreader recently upgraded, and it's awesome. It's very easy. You can actually connect to Drive Shares, some cloud-based services, stuff like that, and pick up your PDFs that way. Nice. I love it. It does PDF text, audio. It'll even do audio video. You can also do USB file transfers, Wi-Fi download. Email attachment. So it's a good all-around reader program, and it works really well. So yeah, goodreader.com, check it out, especially if you have an iOS device. It's really, really good for that. All right, what have you got this week?
I have the it's not Google Maps time lapse, it's the new Google Earth Engine time lapse feature. I don't know how new this is, but the London Free Press covered it, and they had links to some really they embedded different areas of London, Ontario, and so you could see how it grew over the year from 1984, which is a year after I was born, up until now.
Shut up.
Yeah, 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 you old fart. And then I was like, oh, I'm gonna go check out Komoka and Kilworth. Hey, there's time lapse for there too. And then if you load up Google Earth Engine or earthengine.google.com/timelapse, for me, when I went right to the page, it started loading up South Florida. I was like, okay, there's a cool area. Obviously, they had this. They want to highlight the areas where they have a ton of data, and that's fine. I don't know how much coverage there is, but I imagine for most of metropolitan U.S. That should be quite a bit. Certainly any metropolitan area in Canada, Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, Quebec City, London, Calgary, Edmonton, cities that would need their own aerial images anyway. You should be able to get at least a few years there, certainly at least a few years from Google themselves. Definitely play around with it. See if your town, see if you can see your little town or your village or your city grow thanks to Google Earth Engine time lapse. It's really neat just to see how slow or fast your area is growing. It's neat.
Yeah, exactly. So what have we been up to lately? I think I'm still recovering from that darn cold, but I, as I said, I've been playing more with the iPhone 7 Plus. My wife's came in, so we set that one up for her.
Okay.
Got some nice cases. So yeah, it's actually really nice now to have a decent working phone again. And yeah, kind of exploring. I decided to start completely fresh. I didn't restore. My wife decided to restore from a backup. And again, both ways worked well. I'm just really impressed by the speed and that. So starting to think about, that certain time of year, Christmas is coming up. We've got most of the stuff done, but there's still a lot to do and stuff like that. So how about you, counselor?
There's tomorrow will mark our third council meeting in a row for Wednesdays. It's usually every other week. Next week will be three in a row. Or tomorrow would be three in a row because there's a bunch of things to deal with before the end of 2016. This would be our last one for 2016 until I think the second week of January. So that'll be a good break and give me a chance to make sure I'm up to speed on everything, big and small, and procedures and policies and that sort of thing. Otherwise, over at Olio, we've had a few new leads come in. I'm working with those. I'm really confident about one that I've been working on for a couple months. Got word back from one of their existing third-party providers that this small but potentially significant feature is going to cost a lot of money to do right out of the gate. So we're going to, I got to send an email tomorrow and pitch to do it as is, and we'll add this thing later once we make sure that the app actually takes off and does well.
Cool.
So hopefully maybe by the end of the year, we'll have that locked in. That'll be a cool new client. Like I said, picked up a few new leads this week. Around the house, kitchen reno in terms of painting cupboards is all done. It turned out really nice. Spending some more time with family and that sort of thing. Clever Host is chugging Excellent. Along. Yeah, that's about it.
That's about it. Cool. All right. Well, like I say, that's it. So we're going to get this out as soon as we can. So as usual, don't forget to review us on iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn, Stitcher, wherever else you get your podcasts. Retweet us when you see us tweeting something neat or about new episodes. We also have a Facebook page, and you can also send us an email to contact@canadiantechpodcast.ca with different ideas or views or things like that. So for episode 98 for Tuesday, December 13th, 2016, my name is Stuart Clark.
And my name is Derek Silva.
Thank you and be well.